Wow. I don't know if I can follow this. I must admit, Al and I were sitting there, and with Alex was saying, oh, these are the three questions, we said, uh-oh. And so hopefully, we'll touch on the three questions, and I think some overlapping themes as well with Chris. And some of you know me, and those of you don't, my name is Sherry Picto, and I'm Mi'kmaq from the Eltsutuk community. And the Eltsutuk community means where the river flows high or cuts through the rocks. I like to think of it as cutting through the rocks. And otherwise known in English, Bear River First Nation, which is sort of a kinder way of saying that this is Bear River Indian Reserve parcel lands A and B, which is really a reduction, just a fraction of the land and waters we used of our ancestors. And as Alex had introduced me, I've worked in various capacities for Indigenous rights, and in particular the access to manage natural resources, and especially for access to the livelihood and the fishery. And this is as a result of Donald Marshall Jr.'s lifelong struggle with the justice system. The first part of his struggle was 11 years for a crime he did not commit. The second part of that struggle, as many know and that he was famous for, is the struggle with the judicial system all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, which resulted in the Supreme Court of Canada affirming his treaty right, and thus the Mi'kmaq treaty right to access of livelihood in the fishery. I usually don't write things, and you're going to see why I had to write this today. I might be a little bit self-indulgent here. Donald Marshall Jr.'s father, Donald Marshall Sr., and my grandmother, Leona Picto, worked quite closely together along with other Mi'kmaq leaders for treaty rights, or to have those treaty rights affirmed. And these treaty rights did not only encompass natural resources, but basic fundamental human rights, what would be termed as basic fundamental human rights, the right to shelter, the right to food, and the right to life. And for those of you who don't know this, Indigenous people in Canada weren't even considered people till 1960. Despite that there was many Indigenous people that fought in both world wars. So I met Donald Jr. shortly after he was exonerated and released from prison, after he did the 11 years for a crime he didn't commit. And I don't think either of us knew then that we would be uptaking the struggle of our parents and our grandparents. I don't think that this would have been many, many moons ago. And I remember asking at meetings and rallies and so forth, I would propose a question, do I have to carry the fight of my grandmother? Because I found myself in situations where I was, almost repeating what my grandmother was fighting for. And it was for basic Indigenous and human rights. So now, considering the Idle No More movement last year, which was in response to Harper's new legislation, several pieces of legislation, all aimed at industrial development, resource extraction, and privatization, and particularly the privatization of reserve lands now without the consent of the people. And considering the Harper's government stand against, and just recently and still is maintaining that stand against an inquiry to the overwhelming numbers of our missing and murdered sisters. And more recently, the Harper's government stonewalling the principles of responsible investment and agriculture and food systems being put forward by the World Committee on Food Security. Why? Because Canada objects to the reference in those principles to the text of free, prior, and informed consent related to the Universal Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Surprise, surprise. Is this why not Canada held out for so long for endorsing the Universal Declaration in the first place? And when all when I place all these strands of this political economy next to where I am now in my life, I think I'm a little bit older than a lot of you. This is marked by being a mother, and I'm also a grandmother. I just had my 9-year-old granddaughter stay with me last night. And also, as you heard, I'm a student, so I'm a very, very mature interdisciplinary PhD student. I can only conclude that, yes, the struggle does indeed continue, and it's a long struggle. What do I mean by that? The struggle continues, but it also means that in order for the struggle to continue, so does the art form, the radical form, and the radical vision of struggle, or what is at the crux of this festival, the radical imagination. It is a difficult journey with many bumps, hurdles, obstacles that can be right out discouraging. It can easily co-opt many activists or other activists just turn away from the struggle forever because it's such an artist's long journey. Neoliberal processes of capitalism are powerful in that they have a dehumanizing effect, which Chris talked about. They are dehumanizing in the sense that our relationships with nature are severed for capitalist profit. And this is really very difficult on Indigenous people who are trying to retain any bit of their relational understanding and of a reciprocal relationship with nature, the natural environment. It also dehumanizes our relationships with one another through the intrusion of boundaries and walls of racism, greed, sexism, and all the isms that separate us from one another, all of this to support capitalism. And just when you think you have crossed one of these boundaries or transcended through it or overcome one of these hurdles, another one comes along and stands in your way. In this sense, struggle undertakes what the late, I don't know if any of you know this, the late Miles Horton, a lifelong social justice and civil rights activist in the United States out of the Appalachian Mountains. He refers to this, you have to be prepared for the long haul. Oh, it's Chris. You have to be prepared for the long haul. And if any of you don't know Miles Horton, please look him up. wonderful character. Let's examine for a moment what is meant by the long haul in struggle. Thanks to Donald Marshall Jr., the Supreme Court of Canada upheld his treaty right to a livelihood in the fishery, and thus the Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, Passamaquoddy. A victory? Yes. However, what we didn't realize is that in order to implement that treaty right, it would require entering into a fishery that was already heavy and deep into large-scale privatization and commodification. I don't think many people realize, like Marshall, the Supreme Court decision was in 1999. In 1996, the Nova Scotia ground fishermen throughout all of Nova Scotia occupied all the DFO offices, and this was against this privatization. This we learned, our community learned through a very difficult journey and a very courageous one of trying to cross-culturally learn, I guess, with non-Indigenous fishermen. It was a struggle, like, centuries-old racism, you just don't transcend overnight. And I could tell you a zillion stories about that. We were able to finally tell this story. You wouldn't hear this in the news, but we were finally able to tell this through the facilitation of filmmaking by Martha Stegman. And I know a lot of you know her work. She also did the work on Sikun Nudlmuk, a fantastic film. It's free. It's on YouTube. And also another one, Honor Your Word with the Barrier Lake Struggle. You hear very little about the Indigenous fisheries now, and I wonder why. Is it because the federal government managed to integrate the Mi'kmaq on a community-by-community base into the privatization scheme? We'll see. In the meantime, the journey of alliance building, and I was just saying how difficult that was to reach with the non-Indigenous fishermen, it can be very, very difficult, but despite that, if you can do that, and it's sometimes a long journey of learning, continues to serve the collectivity of other struggles against neoliberal destructive development practices of places in which we live. The anti-fracking struggle last year with Elsie Bukduk is an example of this, and the mega quarry, a fight a few years ago, are testaments of such collective struggle. And I'm talking about the mega quarry, which was down in my area quite a few years ago, and it was like a five-year struggle. And the anti-quarry struggle, we did win that one, a victory, yes, but then the U.S.-based company sued the Nova Scotia government under the NAFTA agreement. Makes you wonder, like, you know, whose resources are these? So, more recently, and this will be the punch, more recently, through our collective efforts with the World Forum of Fisher People, the World Forum of Fish Harvesters and Fish Harvesters, the International Collective in Support of Fish Workers, and the International Planning Committee on Food Security, after seven long, arduous years, we managed to have what we pushed for, a little bit watered down from what we wanted, but international guidelines on securing sustainable small-scale fisheries passed at the International Committee on Fisheries, a component of the United Nations FAO Food and Agricultural Organization. This is in June. And within the same week, international NGOs, such as the Global Environment Facility, any of you familiar with this? It's a huge NGO under the guise of environment, but heavily funded by the World Bank. They're demanding, and they're becoming a major player at the table, along with others, for negotiating how these guidelines are to be implemented. This is what a good friend of mine out of McGill University, Dr. Ashish Chaudhry, and his colleague, Dr. Zip Kapoor, out of University of Alberta, they would call NGOization. And so sometimes you have to, you know, in alliance building, you have to really, really dig deep to find out who is the enemy and who's, you know, who's the ally. And I'm already starting to see, like, this major collective at the international level. There's now all these demands of other people to be at the table, and you're starting to see fracturing and disagreement about who should be at that table. This, I was very distraught over, and quite frankly, I'm still working through it. It was like 7 years and you finally get this. And Canada was one of the main stumbling blocks, right? And it also made tonight's panel discussion, of any of those who know me, this is probably a little bit different way of presenting things, but in honor of radical imagination, a bit challenging for me. And I was thinking today, you know, how am I going to prepare for this, you know, because I'm still struggling with this a little bit. But then I thought back to the Mi'kmaq practice of basket weaving, which ironically helped me get through my comprehensive exams as well. And this has been inspired by Bernie Francis. He's a well-known Mi'kmaq linguist, as well as the basketry art of Yersilla Johnson, if any of you who know her work. The basket itself, once woven, is not an end to something, but continues to live on in a multiplicity of relations, rather it is for collecting food, or bought, or sold, or given as a gift. So when I think of the art form living on, one has to conclude, so does the work of Martha Stegman, Alex, and I can't pronounce Alex's last name, he'll have to teach me, Max Haven, L. Jones. I had shared some of Al's poetry with a very good friend of mine in Cape Town. And he was a strong activist in the anti-apartheid movement and actually spent a year in prison. I think some of you I told this story to before, and he was just, he could just so relate to her poem about Mandela. And so also the living art form, you know, goes on like the work of many Indigenous scholars and artists such as Glenn Coulthart, Leanne Simpson, Ursula Johnson, Brian Jungen, Duane Linklater, and many others. All of these radical, if you will, imagists create space for radical envisioning of the future that otherwise would not be available. So many times the plight of my people has been haunted with a sense of self-defeatism because of no space to create an alternative vision for a living. And you heard the struggles from Ellen in prison, and it's sometimes very much like that. And by the way, Indigenous people in Canada have the highest incarceration rates. Thus, my life has been dedicated to imagining the impossible, because only then can we move forward. And I don't know how many times I've been in a room, small struggles, big struggles, and we're handicapped right away. We're silenced right away in the sense that, oh, but the government's not going to let us to do this. And, you know, in my case, oh, DFO will not let us do this. And I have to say, wait a minute, let's pretend none of that was there. Let's just pretend that none of that is there. Then what is the vision? And then we have something to work toward. The point is to remember that when you feel though you cannot go any further, or that you feel that sense of being defeated or knocked down and not able to get up again, and it will happen. Rather, you're in it for survival, or you're in for it for, you know, support. Just remember, it's temporary. Because radical imagination within all of its art forms lives on in their own right, like the basket, and as an inspiration to many others by paving the way for an even more critical analysis by future generations who will continue to create an active struggle for the long haul. So I hope this answers those three questions. A little emotional since I just had my granddaughter. And I also just wanted to honor, for those of you who do not know, Victor Jama. Does that ring a bell? Oh, wow. Okay. Victor Jama was a folk singer, a teacher, and a poet in Chile. And when the coup d'etat happened in September 11th, that's a September 11th we forget about, September 11th, 1973. Mm-hmm. And just a few days later, he was imprisoned along with thousands of other imprisoners because of their ties to socialism. The U.S. had a lot to do with this, and communism. And he's a well-known folk singer, and you can look him up. And within this, the story goes, and there's been some wonderful poems that he even wrote in those few days, or a poem. But what happened was the military took over, and they hauled him out, basically, and they knew he was a guitar player, and they chopped off his fingers. And then, basically, there's two versions of this. One said, get up, bastard, sing now, or you sing now, you bastard, or motherfucker, you sing now. And he got up, and he sang. So did the 6,000 other prisoners. So I dedicate this in his memory, in his name. Thanks.